We're going to start with public hearings. As a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, we're going right down the list as they're listed on the agenda. When we have a full committee here, then we're going to perhaps move to some areas where we have work sessions scheduled. But open a public hearing on House Bill 2051.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2051 comes to you from the Oregon Youth Authority, and it clarifies that the Oregon Youth Authority, not the Department of Human Services, certifies youth offender foster homes. I believe Karen Andall is here. Karen requested an amendment from through our office, Legislative Council's office, yesterday, and the amendment is not ready. So I do not believe we can go to work session today on the bill.
It's not scheduled for a work session, so that works out just fine. Karen, would you please come forward?
Thanks. Good afternoon, Senator Starr and members of the committee. My name is Karen Andall. For the record, I'm with the Oregon Youth Authority, and I would like to briefly provide an overview of this bill and to I did provide written testimony from the agency. Won't go over that in detail, but essentially what this bill does is to clarify that homes that are foster care homes that are certified by the Oregon Youth Authority are available specifically to youth offenders who are in the legal custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. It's basically a cleanup to alleviate any confusion around the types of youth or youth offenders who can be placed in OA foster homes. The proposed discussion on amendments that I've had with Mr. Taylor deal with the fact that although this bill, as in its current form, does deal with the issues I just mentioned, that we have also just noted that there's also a place in the bill that states that offenders over the age of 18 can be placed in youth offender foster homes, which is incongruent with the statute as it currently is stated. So we'll be working with council on that amendment.
Thank you. Questions of Karen?
That amendment has been requested.
We're simply waiting.
Chair, members of the committee, we're waiting for the amendment to come back.
So if we reschedule this for hearing and work session early next week, it would...
I should hope it will be back by then. It's only two words.
If there's no questions or discussion, we will do that and bring it back then early next week.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
That we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2051. And we're going to move on to House Bill. Lost my list. House Bill 2416. No, 50. Excuse me. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2415.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 2415 comes to you from Representative Haas. This bill provides that an abuser may not obtain property from the abused through intestate succession by will, by trust, or from a life insurance policy if the abused dies within 5 years of the abuse. It also prohibits an abuser from obtaining property that is owned jointly with rights of survivorship with the decedent. It provides that a decedent's life estate and property continues in the heirs or devisees for a time equal to the normal life expectancy of the decedent or an abuser has some future interest in the property. Under current law, all these provisions apply to slayers. Slayer is somebody who kills another person. This bill would prohibit abusers from benefiting from the death of the abused in the same way that a slayer is prohibited from benefiting in the death of their victim. This bill passed out of the House unanimously.
Questions from the committee? You'd like to speak on the bill?
I have a little handout on this. If someone would take it and distribute it, please.
This is one of several bills in this session which are...
You must identify yourself.
Excuse me, sir. My name is Bertrand Kopp. I'm a senior advocate. And I testify here in behalf of this bill because I think it's a good idea. It's, however, not as complete as one would like to see it. There are other bills coming, 2416, and there's also Senate Bill, I believe it's 982, which deals with a similar subject. The governor last summer had a hearing in which a number of people participated and came up with legislation. The goal here is to make somebody not enrich himself by killing somebody. This bill, however, has one hitch in it, that it is under Section 3, where people own property by entirety, which means they each own all of it, like a man and a wife own real estate together. And according to the wording of this bill, one can kill the other and still retain half of the proceeds. That may have to be a subject of a later bill. I think I know the reason why 2415 and 2416 were separated. There may be a court test on the technique applied here, that someone may legally predecease another one while walking around for another 50 years. That will live up to the people with the black robes. The other thing I wanted to mention was guardianship law revision is widely spread throughout the United States right now. And I prepared Senate Bill 802, and I wish I could get a hearing before this committee on it. The governor has asked for such legislation. And if you think that guardianship is benevolent, go to the handout, page 3, and look at the lower corner of the paper in which they stripped people of all of their money. For this reason, I'm asking you to yet have a hearing on 802.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Haas, I believe you, this is the bill that you've brought forward. This House Bill 2415 we're having a hearing on now, and appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Senator and committee. Hello, for the record, Mark Haas, Representative, House District 27. I'm here to testify on 2415 and 2416. They're kind of A and B companion bills. 2415 amends what is commonly known as the Slayer Law that dates back to 1917. It was aimed at preventing people from shooting each other so that they could collect or benefit from the victim's will. This change that you see in House Bill 2415 was suggested by attorneys who specialize in elder abuse and by the Elder Abuse Task Force, and it would prohibit people convicted of abusing someone and then later benefiting from the will when that person dies. This, in part, stemmed from a notorious case in Washington County in my district where a caregiver met a man at a coffee shop, or I should say became his caregiver after meeting him, befriended him, and literally stole from his checking account and his assets hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, they were actually able to criminally convict her and send her to prison, but she managed to get into this person's will. And this person, who is ill now, may die, and she may still, as she's sitting in prison today, collect from his will, because there is no law that will guarantee that, even though she was convicted of ripping him off, can bar her from being a beneficiary in that will. This will change cases like that. They don't happen a lot, but they do happen on an increasing number of times. So, according to the National Center on Elder Abuse, in 2000, 516 cases of seniors and people with disabilities reported financial abuse in Oregon. So sadly, elder abuse is on the rise. As Oregon's population ages, these crimes are also almost certain to increase. So Thank you for considering this. I do want to say that it was sort of legally sanitized and cleaned up by some of the legal eagles on the House Judiciary Committee, and so I would encourage your favorable adoption of it.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, regarding the effective dates, I can see what they say on them before or after. Did the House actually look at this as a need to maybe do a emergency clause to get it on the books sooner than later, and then it would have the effect quicker than whenever the act goes into effect? Because I don't see a date certain in here as to when it would actually go into effect.
Same thing.
Besides the January 1, 06.
Yeah, I just thought it was the January date, and I don't think thought was given to that emergency clause.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. The reason I ask is based on the story you just told us, if this is something that I don't know if it could be affected.
It could not apply to that case of that woman. So
at this point,
that's not the issue.
But the person could still be written out of the will.
Yes, Timothy Marble, who I distributed a letter, who actually helped defend that man and was active on the Elder Abuse Task Force, has concluded that whatever we do here, it won't have any impact on her because of the retroactive. And I think lawyers have a phrase for changing the law after the
fact. Actual facto type thing, but that's on the criminal side. But yeah.
Further questions. We've only scheduled these for public hearing today, Representative, so we're going to, there's no question, no further questions on 2415. We're going to close the public hearing on 2415 and open public hearing on 2416. Representative House.
For the record, Mark Hatz, Representative, House District 27. In 2003, we passed, and it passed both chambers unanimously, House Bill 2449 to help seniors recover treble damages. I have been told during this last year that that law was in effect. It's been a tremendous deterrent and a benefit to seniors from unscrupulous accountants or annuity salesmen. When this was going through the last session, representatives from the disabled population came to us and said, could you add us to your bill? And at the time, it was what seemed like late in the session. Turned out it wasn't, but it seemed like it was late and would put the bill in jeopardy if we started amending it. And the decision was made to wait until this session. So that's what this bill does. It just adds disabled people to that triple damages law. And I'm optimistic, based on what we've seen from this 2003 law, that it will have the same sort of deterrent effect and give one more layer of protection to our disabled population.
Any questions? Sounds very reasonable.
Hey.
Appreciate very much. If there's...
You know, when I was in television, I used to get ratings sort of like this.
Uh-huh.
Well, right. You know you're in good hands when you have more staff than members.
Thank you very much. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2416 and open public hearing on House Bill 2978. Council.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 2978A permits a court in a dissolution and separation or separation judgment to order a revocation of beneficiary designations made by one spouse in favor of another spouse on certain financial assets.
Thank you. And we have John Case.
Hey.
Please, John, come tell us about this.
Thank you, Chair Starr, and the committee. My name is John Case. I'm an attorney at the Oregon State Bar. I'm here representing the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. This was a bill that we prepared and submitted in the Oregon State Bar. Family law section is behind this bill. I've prepared written testimony, which I believe is being handed out to you now, and I won't go into repeating everything that is in that written testimony, but I'm more here just to answer any questions that you may have about the bill. Essentially, what the bill does is remedy an ongoing problem that family law practitioners and parties in our state encounter when going through a divorce process or an annulment or a legal separation, where unintended consequences can occur following the divorce being concluded. And I'll just use divorce as the example to help explain to you what the situation is. When parties are divorced in Oregon and one party is awarded a retirement account free from any claim by the ex-spouse, that retirement account often has a beneficiary designation. That beneficiary designation is not altered or revoked unless another additional affirmative act is taken after the divorce case. Sometimes a spouse will neglect to make that change. The court, the attorneys, the parties, and the judge all consider that asset awarded to one party and not the other. And unanticipated death can often result in an ex-spouse receiving a windfall of being paid the entire beneficiary portion of that account, life insurance policy, retirement account, whatever it may be, when that was not the intent of the divorce judgment. This bill simply permits the parties to include in their divorce judgment a clause that provides for that situation so that the unintended consequence doesn't occur.
Questions? Thank you. It seems to be very straightforward. Doesn't look like a lot of opposition. We're going to move on, close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On House Bill 2978, and we will be opening then public hearing on House Bill 3266. And we have Mr. Tim Martinez signed up for that.
Council?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 3266 modifies the definition of financial institutions in relation to a seller's property disclosure statement. Specifically, trust companies would be included in the definition of financial institutions. This would make it so that trust companies would not be required to provide a seller's disclosure statement.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I classify this bill as one of what I lovingly call the Full Employment Act for Ken Sherman Jr., the OBA counsel, and Tim Martinez, their lobbyist. When Ken participated in developing the revisions to the Bank Act a few years ago, he purposely left out trust companies in the underlying definition, which is commonly used throughout the statutes. And he explains to me he did that because, you know, it's not necessarily applicable in all cases. Well, it seems to me since we've rewritten the Bank Act in, I think it was 1997, every session Ken finds one or two places where he says, yes, we should have done it there. And this is an example of that. The seller's disclosure is the form that a seller gives to a potential buyer when they're looking at purchase property. Occasionally, trust companies do get property back through estates, and it really makes no sense for them to have to go through that disclosure piece since they really don't know anything about the property. The realtors have no problem with this. This had no objection on the House side, and my recollection is the vote was very favorable in the House. I'm not aware of any no votes, frankly. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I think it's, as counsel explained, a fairly simple little bill.
Questions? Appreciate it. Unanimous vote out of the House. No opposition here. Mr. Martinez, we believe that this will move when we get it on a work session. We'll set it next week and take care of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3266. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2144. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2144 would modify conditions of probation for a person previously convicted of a sex offense as an adult or previously found within the jurisdiction of a juvenile court for having committed an act that would have constituted a sex offense if committed by an adult. It also captures out-of-state offenses. It is here at the request of the Department of Justice, I believe. Department of Corrections, I apologize, and it is in response to a couple of cases that came down recently where probation officers had looked at a probationer's criminal history, had noted a sex offense in the past, and wanted to have that person undergo some additional sex offender treatment, but because the instant offense was an out-of-state conviction, the court ruled that the individual could not be required to undergo that additional treatment.
Thank you. We have Ginger Martin and Pat Schreiner.
Of the committee. I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, here to provide information on House Bill 2144. Council did a nice job summarizing the major concepts in the bill and the reason that we would like this bill. Currently, when someone is convicted of a new felony and put on probation, the probation department will run a check to see what other past convictions are part of this person's history. And when they are, when they find a sex offense, they can then decide whether or not to evaluate this person, and they may wish to put this person on a higher level of supervision or require sex offender treatment. Currently, though, the probation department cannot take into account sex crimes that were committed in other states or when the individual was a juvenile. And so we would like to have this, what we see as a loophole in our authority, to take into account the entire history of the individual and to supervise then people at the proper level based on an evaluation of their risk to the public.
Question?
Chair Starr and members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm the commander of the Parole and Probation Division, and I'm testifying in support of this bill on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. Ginger Martin summed it up well, as did Heidi Boad. That is exactly what we're looking for. I can tell you personally from the experience of Marion County that we have over 500 sex offenders under supervision in Marion County, and really all we're looking for is, it's not like we're looking for more to supervise, but we do, in the interest of public safety, want to have the ability to assess these people. And if we look at their history and see that this is somebody that presents a risk to the community, we know that supervision and treatment do a significant job of reducing that risk. And so we just want to have the ability to assess those people, and if they need treatment, to mandate that treatment go along with their supervision. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. John Hummel.
Members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. House Bill 2144 would permit a probation officer to order sex offender treatment if a person has a previous adult conviction for a sex offense that was committed in another state. OCDLA is fine with that. That's appropriate. You might be aware that advancing through this legislative assembly right now is a bill that says anytime Oregon law talks about a conviction in Oregon, it means a conviction in any state. And we need to clean up that loophole that's in our laws. So the fact that this bill does it directly in this situation is fine. Hopefully in next session we won't have to be doing this piecemeal because that other bill will pass. So OCDLA is fine with that. However, We do oppose the expansion to encompass juvenile offenses because it could produce unjust results. And here's an example. Suppose you have a 16-year-old child who commits a statutory rape offense in Oregon or another state. The out-of-state isn't relevant to this example. A 16-year-old commits a statutory rape offense. They're adjudicated in juvenile court. They're ordered to complete sex offender treatment and jail and community service, and they do all that, and they do it as well as could be done, and they successfully complete their probation. 30 years go by. 30 years later, that young boy is now 46 years old. He's raised a family. He's stayed crime-free. He's held down a reputable job. He commits a DUI offense. Nothing good about that, and I'm not going to be here to embrace DUI offenses, but he commits a DUI offense. His first criminal offense, he's 46 years old. Probation department orders sex offender treatment because he has a previous sex offense that was committed as a juvenile. A juvenile offender should have the opportunity to work hard, follow the orders of the judge, complete their treatment, and move on with their life. This bill would never let a juvenile offender pay their debt to society because the debt would always be owed, always, till their deathbed. That debt will be owed. For those reasons, I respectfully suggest that this bill be passed, but with the juvenile offense section deleted. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. That's a real interesting argument that raises an alarm in my head. Did you go to the House and testify on this bill and give the same argument?
Senator Walker, yes, I did. Thank you for the question. Perhaps I wasn't as articulate as I was here, but we did testify that we were fine with the expansion to adult offenses, but we objected to the inclusion of juvenile offenses.
And they passed, Mr. Chairman, I continue, and they passed it over your objection anyway, correct?
Yes, Senator Walker did.
Let me ask you, without getting up and walking over to look at what is under the statute here, I'm looking at Section E of the bill. I can't see with my glasses on or off today. So, ORS, it says, was previously found by a court in another jurisdiction to have committed an act while under 18 years of age that would constitute a sex offense under ORS 163.305 to 163.467 if committed by an adult in the state. Can you explain that paragraph and also explain to me what those offenses are under that statute?
Certainly, Chair Starr, Senator Walker. Paragraph E is the same as paragraph D above it, with the exception that paragraph E talks about offenses committed in another state. So paragraph D and E are basically saying the same thing. One's for Oregon offenses, one's for out-of-state offenses. What they're saying is, and this is standard language in any juvenile code, what we say is if a juvenile offender does an act that would constitute an adult crime. If you look in the adult code and something's illegal, if a juvenile does that, it's a juvenile offense. It's not an adult conviction. So this says if the juvenile was 18 and violated the class of crimes that are listed there, they would come under the statute. The class of crimes that are listed there, that's a broad range. Those are the adult sex offenses.
So, Mr. Chair, I can continue. The thing that I worry about the most, and you know me long enough to know I'm really hardcore on putting sex offenders in jail, and actually think we could probably do a lot more to them that isn't allowable under the law, but the concern I have are juveniles. There's a three-year limitation, if I'm understanding. You may engage in intercourse with someone that's within that three-year range. If you're older than a certain age and the person is younger than a certain age, that you become a sex offender because you've committed statutory rape. Can you explain that? Because I'm not doing very well at it today, but that's where I'm concerned. If they're a juvenile and they get caught up in that and that becomes something later on that follows them. Can you explain that for me?
Certainly, Senator Walker and Chair Starr. Certain sex offenses have this age defense. If you are within a certain age range of the victim, that's a defense that you can present. You're not guilty if you can show you were within a certain age range of the victim. Other sex offenses, you don't have that defense. And to tell you which ones you do and which ones you don't, I'd have to do more research. I'm not recalling off the top of my head, but certain offenses, you do have that age range defense.
Well, Ms. Chair, I appreciate the explanation, and I'm just not tracking today. There were too many trains going by my house last night. I didn't get much sleep. But I'm real concerned about this because generally crimes that are committed as a juvenile are not counted when you're an adult. And so under this house bill that we're looking at here, they would include that in probation in terms of whether you would be a sex offender, and that's your understanding. Is that correct, Mr. Hummel?
Senator Walker, I don't know if I'm exactly tracking with you. What this bill does is it says that a probation officer is allowed to look at a defendant's previous record, and if they see that a defendant has previously committed a sex offense as a juvenile, the probation officer can order sex offender treatment now.
Right.
That's what the bill says. It doesn't have anything to do with counting juvenile sex offenses for anything other than treatment ordered by a probation officer.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I would just say that I have some concerns about this bill. I know we're not moving it today, which is a darn good thing, because I need some more questions answered about this, because I'm just not comfortable with it.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I tend to agree with you. I think for a statutory rape, we're talking about a three-year difference in age as what constitutes statutory rape. But in any event, this bill will be set over. We'll talk with Senator Burdick when she gets back to see what we do as far as possible amendments. And in the meantime, I think we've explored this issue.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close public hearing on House Bill 2144. And while I've got a full committee here now, we're going to open up Senate Judiciary as a full committee. We're going back to the top of the order. Looked at a work session on, a possible reconsideration and work session on Senate Bill 806.
Mr. Chair.
Counsel, would you guide us a little bit? I think we have to...
The motion.
We have to rescind the... Well, we have to reconsider the vote by which we passed it. We must rescind the amendments.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we move to suspend the rules.
Okay.
And then we move from a motion for possible reconsideration.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules of the committee for the intent to possibly reconsider Senate Bill 806 based on the vote that we passed it.
Thank you. Senator Prozanski has moved that we... I lost the wording already.
Reconsider.
That we suspend the rules so that we might reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 806. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Yes, Chair.
Let's let counsel tell us what we need to do here.
Sure.
We just suspended the rules.
So now we would have a motion to reconsider.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote that we passed Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Prozanski has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. To the motion. Uh,
Mr. Chair, I understand there might be some reconsideration as to the amendments that may have gone forward and as to what we might want to reconsider. That's the purpose of the motion.
Thank you. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 806 comes to you from Senator George. And last week, before this committee, May 9th, before this committee, we sent the bill out having adopted the Dash 2 amendments, which may be in your file. You have before you the Dash 4, and let me explain what has happened. What this bill does, it expands the definition of public body under the Oregon Tort Claims Act to include a private nonprofit organization that provides transportation services. As originally drafted, the Dash 2 amendments, what they did was to narrow that in the sense that the nonprofit would be receiving more than 50% of its funds for public transportation from a public body. It was further suggested that we narrow so it only included the tort claim limitations for those services that related to public transportation where it was receiving 50% of its funds. The language that we got from Legislative Counsel's office stated for the purposes of ORS 30.260 to 30.300, a private nonprofit organization as described and operates within the scope of state employment duties only when providing public transportation services. After this bill passed out, the Department of Administrative Services called me and expressed concerns that somehow we were making these people state employees. They had a conversation for Legislative Counsel's office, and although Legislative Counsel's office did not necessarily agree with them, they did say that it could be stated in a clearer fashion. So that this bill would not somehow get a fiscal impact statement on that none of us could have imagined at the time also, I asked Legislative Counsel's office for a new amendment to the bill, which reads a private nonprofit organization as described under 30.2604F is subject to ORS 30.260 to 300 only for the purposes of providing public transportation services. Pretty simple fix to what could have been a ambiguity of the statute that was not intended.
So we need to rescind the Dash 2 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And substitute the Dash 4 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Prezansky. I make a motion that we rescind the Dash 2s that were incorporated into the bill that passed out of this committee on Senate Bill 806.
Senator Prezansky has moved we rescind the Dash 2 amendments, which we formally passed into this bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We need now to move the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the Dash 4 amendments in the Senate Bill 806.
Senator Barr has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 806. Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Barr has moved Senate Bill 806 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator George will carry the bill. We've closed the work session on Senate Bill 806. We're going to open a work session on HCR 11. Well, I guess we'll start with public hearing. Let me reverse myself. We'll have public hearing on HCR 11.
Yeah.
And we've council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. HCR 11 is here to recognize the contributions of Robert Coons to crime victims' rights in Oregon. As I'm sure most of you know, Mr. Coons passed away in April of 2004, and this bill seeks to recognize all that he did for crime victims in Oregon, including founding Oregon Crime Victims United in 1983. I apologize. The staff measure summary I sent out to you earlier earlier this week did not include that there are Dash 1 amendments for this group to consider. The Dash 1 amendments would recognize that Mr. Kuhn's wife, Dee Dee, also retired with Mr. Kuhn's, and that is on page 1, line 13, that whereas in 1997, both of the Kuhn's retired as the head of Crime Victims United.
Thank you. We, Steve Dole and Ann Trapp, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. For the record, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I think it's fitting and it's proper that every once in a while in our busy days at the legislature that we stop to take just a few minutes to recognize both politicians and individual citizens who have made great contributions to our state. And that's why we're here today, to talk about Bob Kuhn's. I'd like to point out, if I could, that when we ran this through the House, it was run as a surprise. Dee Kuhn's did not know anything about it. And in fact, we did keep it from her until the day that we had the floor session. However, the cat's out of the bag, and she is here today. So for those of you, I think most of you on the committee know Dee Dee, but for those of you who don't, or those in the room, Dee Dee is in the room today, and I'd ask her to just stand for a moment, please. And Dee Dee Kuhn's is the widow of Bob Kuhn's. thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill. We do appreciate it. Bob Kuhn's was my mentor, and like the older brother that I never had. But most of all, he was a very good friend to me. And as you all know, in today's culture, good friends and true friends are hard to come by. The same tragic circumstances that brought us together, the murders of our only daughters, Bob's Valerie in 1980 and my Lisa in 1992. Ironically, the same year that Bob and Dee Dee's daughter, Valerie, was murdered was the same year, 1980, that my daughter was born. And the same year that Bob was originally diagnosed with cancer was the same year that my daughter was murdered in a strange, ironic twist. Bob set the values for the crime victims movement and was one of the founders of Crime Victims United. Bob died on April 29, 2004, after a long battle with cancer. Bob Kuhn's, along with his wife, Dee Dee, joined the Portland chapter of Parents of Murdered Children in 1982. Their daughter, Valerie McDonald, had been abducted in California in 1980 and never heard from again. Her remains were identified in the year 2000. During the investigation into Valerie's murder and through their involvement in POMC, they became aware of the horrible state of criminal justice in Oregon at that time. Victims of violent crime routinely received no respect and often little justice from the criminal justice system, a system which failed miserably at holding criminals accountable and protecting decent citizens. Bob and Dee Dee, along with the help of other members of Parents of Murdered Children, led the way in creating Crime Victims United in 1983 to work for crime victims' rights and a more balanced criminal justice system. For the next 14 years, Bob was leader of the group, serving as president and in other capacities. Even after retiring in 1997, Bob was an invaluable advisor to the group along with Dee Dee. In 1984, Bob, with Dee Dee, led the efforts to get a victims' rights measure on the ballot. Measure 8 was narrowly defeated. In 1986, another measure, Measure 10, was advanced and passed, putting victims' rights into Oregon law. Both times, Crime Victims United members personally gathered tens of thousands of signatures to bring the measure to the voters. In 1996, Bob was the main author of Measure 26, which recast the founding principles of criminal justice in Oregon as protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. Measure 26, the culmination of 12 years of effort, passed handily and has had a profound effect. Bob was involved in many other ballot measures, including the 1996 and 1999 measures that placed victims' rights in the Oregon Constitution. These measures ensured that victims' rights were enforceable and that victims had constitutional standing. Bob and Didi participated in countless work groups, committees, and commissions. Of particular note was their contributions to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission in 1987 and 88, and their participation in the Juvenile Justice Summit in 1994 that led to the restructuring of the juvenile justice system through Senate Bill 1. Bob, working in close partnership with his wife, Didi, personally helped hundreds of victims of violent crime navigate the choppy waters of the criminal justice system. At a time when survivors were reeling from the most devastating loss, he brought expertise, wisdom, and comfort. And I was the benefactor, as were hundreds of others. Using his vast experience, sound moral compass, and penetrating intellect, Bob made a huge contribution toward the mission of Crime Victims United to create a more balanced criminal justice system, one in which the interests of victims and law-abiding citizens were accorded due weight. He advanced this mission through testimony before the Oregon legislature, by working with virtually every criminal justice agency and state government, by participating in ballot measure campaigns, and through appearances in the media. He was an eloquent spokesman and a compelling advocate. We believe that no one has made a greater contribution to the state of Oregon's crime victims and criminal justice system than Bob Coons. His selfless and tireless work for the benefit of all law-abiding Oregonians was an inspiration. We loved him and will sorely miss him. And thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Representative Crummell to give his testimony at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. House concurrent resolution was introduced to memorialize Bob Coons and the passing of him a year ago. And this was something that I had decided after his wake last May that I was going to do when the new session arrived in January. He was a constituent of mine, and his wife Didi still is a constituent of mine. They were also and are also friends and advocates for victims in every sense of the word. To me, it's also a very personal thing, and the reason why is because well over 40 years ago, Valerie and I were friends, and we played together in our yards. Didn't matter whether it was the Coons' yard or my yard, but we played together. And I used to walk Valerie to school once in a while, and I was about 8 years old, and she was about a year or two younger than I am. And it's funny how life turns out, because we used to play in the neighborhood, and I'd walk Valerie to school, and then 40 years later, Bob and Didi were walking with me through the halls of the Capitol. And it's interesting how life gives us these little turns. But I have a lot of memories, very fond memories of the Coonses, Bob and Didi, and actually the entire family. But what I'm most impressed about is the work that they have done on behalf of victims everywhere. They have really, they took what was an absolutely devastating situation and really turned it around, and using, I couldn't have done it, I can tell you that, but really turned it around to make sure that victims everywhere, particularly in Oregon, had the opportunity to have some rights within the judicial process. And Bob and Didi, I would, they made Crime Victims United a very formidable force. And I'm going to read for a second from an article that you should or may have in front of you.
made Crime Victims United a formidable force for victims' rights in Oregon. When they retired from the organization in 1997, they reflected on a time when victims often weren't allowed in courtrooms and were treated like a piece of evidence. And I think they really brought the human side to the victims and to the courtroom and helping victims. Bob Coons was tireless, and he cut across political boundaries. It wasn't a partisan fight to him or a partisan thing. And this is a quote from Josh Marquis, Clatsop County District Attorney. Bob was a remarkable mediator who didn't let his own personal loss make him ineffective. He wasn't afraid to call prosecutors for help and sometimes called him and sometimes I called him for help. So it's interesting that the DA would be then calling Bob for help. But Bob and Dudy were really a team, and because of that, and I think one of the things that we want to do is recognize that they were a team. And so before you should also have a -1 amendment, and this is a very simple amendment in the body of the resolution, if I can find my copy here, is at line 13. It states that Bob Coons retired as head of Crime Victims United, and in talking with the family, in talking specifically with Dee Dee, and recognizing that they really were a team with regards to Crime Victims United and a lot of the work that was being done, I would propose the -1 amendments, which would delete Bob Coons retired as the head and insert the Coonses retired as the leaders. So it would read at line 13, whereas in 1997 the Coonses retired as the leaders of Crime Victims United but remained active in campaigns and causes to help raise awareness of the needs of crime victims and volunteered to bring dignity and respect to the victims living and dead, and then it would just continue on. And I think that recognizing that they really were a team is extremely important, and I think it's also very appropriate. But I can tell you this, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I wish we weren't here today. I mean, I'm glad that we're here and in session, but I wish we weren't here today discussing this memorial. I wish Valerie had never been murdered, and I wish Bob and Dee Dee had never had to have gone through the suffering and losing a daughter, and especially in this kind of situation. And I wish Bob were still alive, obviously, so that we could all tell him thank you one last time. But I don't regret the impact that Valerie's case has had on them and on the rest of Oregon because of the work that Bob and Dee Dee Coons have done in turning their sorrow and frustration into determination and energy. I would say, I guess, all of the right ingredients for helping other victims. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will close. And it's my hope that you'll take this to work session, put the amendment in, and then move it to the full committee or to the floor, whichever you, which I'm not sure where it's coming from here, but to the floor would be absolutely terrific, and I would really welcome that, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that testimony. Compelling.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, but I'm speaking on my own behalf today. I'm definitely in favor of HCR 11. Some people refer to us as crime vics, but I would like to tell you what crime victims who appear before you in these committees are really about. We are much, much more than those two little words. Crime victims have nothing to lose. We have already lost it. There's nothing that can be taken from us we haven't already lost. Absolutely nothing. Bob Coons realized that. No one asked us if we wanted to be victims. Others made that choice for us. We are just to struggle with what's left. Bob knew that too. Crime victims have no political aspirations. That's not why we're here. It's simply to do what's right. Crime victims are here because they care about their fellow man, woman, and child. Bob Coons worked with his heart and soul so potential victims would be treated justly and fairly, and with the hope they would not become the current or future victims. Bob and Dee Dee changed history. Bob and Dee Dee Coons and their dedication to crime victims changed the future in Oregon. I was one of those future crime victims that Bob Coons was fighting for. I was kept informed of the court dates. I was entitled to be heard, and I was allowed to deliver a victim impact statement, and I was able to survive. We have no way to know who will be next. It's not something you plan for. This path certainly isn't the one I would have chosen. I'm not really here by choice, but I'm also here because I feel compelled to be here for those potential future victims who will ultimately follow in my footsteps. Bob Coons paved the way for all of us, whether we realize it or not, at this moment in time. And I'm here to ask you to honor Bob Coons and to please pass House Concurrent Resolution 11 in Bob Coons' name. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Again, I thank you. And I call Paul Snyder forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here today in support of HCR 11. I've known Bob and Dee Dee Coons for many, many years when they were Crime Victims United. And we didn't always agree on the issues, but we almost always agreed. And the things that struck me the most about the two of them, Bob and Dee Dee, was their tenacity in search of solutions to the problems for themselves and for victims who are yet to come, their remarkable ability to listen when someone else would come to them and talk with them about a different perspective on the issue. I always felt welcome and I always felt heard whenever I would talk with them about issues that were of common interest to us. The third was a remarkable capacity on both their parts to go out to places, including, for example, McLaren, talking with juvenile offenders, seeking very desperately to get them to turn their lives around so that there weren't going to be more victims in the future. All those characteristics were ones that I really admired, and I'd strongly support HCR 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Any questions? We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, open the work session on this bill. I think it's ready to move with the amendment. So I'll close the public hearing on HCR 11, open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Przanski.
I move the dash ones into for HCR 11.
Senator Przanski has moved the dash one amendments to HCR 11. Comments or discussion?
I think it's a great bill to honor some really great people, Mr. Chair, so I think it's wonderful.
Any opposition to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill or House Concurrent Resolution 11 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved HCR 11 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I wonder if we could ask Ms. Coons if she has anyone in the Senate that she'd like to have this carried by as a carrier for the resolution.
Senator Starr.
Senator.
I think Chair Burdick, actually.
Chair Burdick. Chair Burdick had indicated she'd like to carry the bill. I think we'll just favor her with that and let Senator Burdick carry HCR 11 on the Senate floor. With that, we close the work session on HCR 11. Go back to our public hearing. Thank you very much for bringing this to us. I believe we were down to House Bill 2145. Open up. Public hearing on House Bill 2145. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2145 provides that county parole and probation officers have the power of peace officers in the execution of some of their duties. Essentially, some laws were changed back in 1997, and under Oregon law, Department of Corrections or a judge has the authority to appoint a probation officer. Because the counties now are responsible for operating felony probation, they've had to go through the courts to get these people appointed, and so this is really a housekeeping matter that brings the current law into current law up to date with current practice, and then it goes through and makes multiple conforming changes throughout the revised statutes.
Thank you, Council. We have Ginger Martin signed up to testify on this one. Please.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, this is a pretty simple housekeeping bill. We at the Department of Corrections forwarded this after responding to concerns from county community corrections agencies. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about it.
Other questions? Senator Prozinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess when it says the P&P officers will have the powers of peace officers, can you give us exactly what areas that you feel they do not have now as correction or probation officers and what they will actually be getting? And also, I think the other part of concern, or not concern, but question would be their status as to do they become designated as peace officers for all purposes?
Senator, this bill does not change the powers that probation parole officers currently have as peace officers in executing their duties. So it neither expands nor limits the powers they have currently. It makes clear that counties can appoint them as well as the department and the judge. So probation parole officers now are able to, for example, arrest people under their supervision with a warrant or for a violation of conditions of supervision. They are able to do warrantless searches of cars and homes as part of their job as a supervising officer. It's not changing any of the current powers they have. They are all peace officers in a limited way because their peace officer status relates to those who are under supervision rather than to general citizens. In other words, they can't arrest you.
I just want to put on the record as to what their limitations are and what they can or can't do. So, and I assume their status within their current rankings as for PERS and stuff is staying the same.
Correct.
Just so we make sure everyone understands what we have before us. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate testimony. I think this bill is ready to move, but we are not having a work session today, so we'll send it over for a future work session. That we're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2145, open a public hearing on House Bill 2723. And we have Brian DeLashman and Glenn Scruggs. Tell us about it.
Mr. Chair,
let's let the council introduce first. I'm sorry.
By all means.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2723 would require an employer to grant a leave of absence to a public safety officer who is participating on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training or on one of that board's committees. Essentially, you'll see from the SMS that the statutes establish that board and establish persons to be appointed by the governor. And this would allow a police officer to participate without having to take a leave of absence or to have to take a vacation day, essentially, to participate.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Council has done a good job of summarizing what the bill is really all about, but if I may just go just a step or two beyond that. In the state, obviously, this is a very, very valuable committee, and I've been before you testifying about DPSST and the composition and so forth. But if you understand the composition, there's 24 members, there's very limited input from those officers that are actually line officers in the street, whether it's police officer, firefighter, or a corrections officer. And we have run into at least one situation you'll hear about in which an employer, for whatever reason, determined that he didn't want that person to serve on that board or commission. And if you look at the broader picture of this is a statewide board in, that functions for multiple purposes, including setting the standards and the training for those officers, reviewing their certifications and so forth, it's very valuable to have this whole mix of input into that. And if, in fact, there is the ability to deny a particular person from serving on this board because the employer won't allow them the time off, and I'll get into that in just a minute as far as time off, it does, in fact, dilute the I think the real function of this board. There has been some questions, what is the real time? How much time are we really talking about here? It's very limited time. And you can ask Glenn when he testifies. He's on one of the subcommittees, the policy subcommittees. But you're really talking about 4 or 5 meetings a year for a half a day. And this bill doesn't require that the employer pay for prep time and a whole variety of other things. If you were to see an agenda for the DPSST, it is like this. And they spend a substantial amount of their own time in the evenings going through that, working on that, preparing themselves for those meetings. So what we're really talking about here is just the ability for those officers to attend the meetings. And do the function that has some statewide interest, obviously. And with that, I'll turn it over to Glenn.
Right. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Scruggs. I'm a police officer for the City of Tigard and president of their police association. And as president of that association, I've been appointed to the DPSSD subcommittee, the police policy committee, and have been doing that for about 4 years now. When I was initially appointed, I approached my chief about the requirements of my attending the meetings. And his initial response was that, no, we weren't going to allow you to do that on work time. You'll have to use your compensation time or vacation time, and only when that's allowable. We, of course, have shift minimums, and if we were going to be at minimums, they wouldn't pay overtime to allow me to go. It's obviously a problem since attendance at the meetings is pretty important. We broached the subject that there were other members in the police department who were allowed to attend meetings on work time, management personnel. And they went back to their legal counsel, and legal counsel advised them you can't have disparate treatment amongst employees of the city. And that actually resolved the subject for the time. And since then, I have been allowed to attend the meetings on work time. There's no overtime involved in terms of my attending. Essentially, I'm on graveyard right now. I will flex my schedule, so they will allow me off at 4 a.m. so I can attend a meeting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's about 4 hours for me with my commute and actually attending the meeting. The meetings are quarterly. I am a member of a subcommittee right now, so I've had a couple of other meetings, but you're still talking less than 10 meetings in a year.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Witt.
Just a quick question. Could you envision a situation where a smaller rural agency could have difficulty adhering to this program?
Definitely more difficulty than our department does, being a little larger. The meetings, though, are given to us well in advance. We have the entire year. And what I do is I immediately turn around and provide that to my immediate supervisor, so he's able to block off that on that date I'm going to be gone, and therefore they won't approve leave time for somebody else but place them below minimums. And in that way, they haven't had to pay any overtime for my attending the meetings.
And if I may, Mr. Chair and Senator, one of the trade-offs, obviously, is that the wider the diversity is on these committees, including those authors from small communities, I think the better off we all are. So there is some trade-off, but it's a valid question to ask.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
A follow-up on that, perhaps more of a comment. I can think of areas in my district where backup is 45 minutes to an hour and a half away from an individual, and so that having someone that would normally be there that isn't, it could be a real problem. And so I think it is a problem, and it's reassuring to know that those meetings are set way in advance and that you would have that opportunity to find someone to cover your position before you left.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony.
Thank you.
We will be setting this over for future work session next week. With that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2724. And Mr. Lashman's back with us.
We're going to have the council tell us
about this bill, and then we're going to
need to speak up quicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2724 would provide that home addresses, telephone numbers, and email addresses of public safety officers would be exempt from disclosure under the public records law. We do have a dash one amendment that's here because of the county clerk's concern that they would have to go back through decades of real property and lien records, and so the dash one amendments exclude the address and telephone numbers on county real property or lien records now, and this is in an effort to make it more difficult for people to track down officers when they are off duty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Brian DeLashmit representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Let me start by saying one of the things that the Oregon Council of Police Associations probably holds nearest and dearest to its heart is the officers' safety in this state. I know all of us are concerned about this. This bill came to us from several officers in the state that raised the question about the ability for the bad guys to get access to their records of addresses and telephone numbers and either threaten to do nasty things to them and their family or actually attempt to do those things. I wasn't aware of the situation, but and as Deputy Cardinal will tell you, I've heard of cases now in which officers' families have been threatened. That information is readily accessible as far as their telephone number and their home address by simply calling the local tax office and saying, does Joe Smith own property in this county? And the clerk says yes, and the address is. And as a result, then, while the officers are still on duty, their family is exposed. The perp knows the address of the officers. And I've heard of cases in which officers have received notes, families have received notes, in which it is basically summarized. The note says, we know where you live, and you can't protect yourself. We know where your children go to school and what time they get off school, and you can't protect them. And so this bill is an attempt to get at that particular issue. We are aware of the Dash 1 amendments. I did have a conversation with the clerk who is here to testify on this about a month ago. I have no problems. This is the first time I've seen the Dash 1s, but I think they accomplished their goals, and we have no problem with the Dash 1s. The one other question, and I'll let Deputy tell you about his case, is that we do, however, have some issue if there is additional issues raised on this. I've heard one of the questions about how does the clerk know whether this person is a police officer in order to be able to block those records. And without being prescriptive in statute, I think we made an intentional, conscious decision not to put a whole process in there, but allow that to each county to determine whether or not they're just going to simply have a form in which the officers that want to have this information blocked can go in and actually sign up with the clerk to say, for this purpose, I don't want this information released. So we think rather than being prescriptive in statute, we just soon leave it to each clerk to make that decision or that determination. With that, I'll turn it over to Officer, who I think has a very compelling story to tell you.
Thank you. Please. Is it Dan?
Correct. Good afternoon, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Dan Cardinal, and I'm a law enforcement deputy for the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I work in the traffic safety unit. On January 12th of 2004, just about approximately 20 minutes prior to the end of my shift, I received a panicked phone call from my wife on my cell phone. She had indicated that she had located a letter on her front doorstep. And the letter indicated from the reading of it that it apparently had come from an individual that I'd had contact with while in the course of my duties. I'll read you a short piece of the letter. And the letter indicated from the individual that it said, you can't protect yourself, your family, or your residence. The letter is about a matter of probably about a half a page long. The investigation was turned over to the local police department in which I live. And it was a matter of about 24 hours of just pure misery. Myself and my family were unable to identify who this individual was or what their intentions were. Detectives eventually were able to locate who this individual was, and a subsequent interview with this individual, they were able to determine that within a matter of 3 hours, I'd had a contact with this individual on a traffic stop. I'd issued him a citation, and within 3 hours, he was able to locate where I lived. He was able to draft this letter, and from the location where he resides, it's a matter of 30 minutes from his residence to my residence. And then within that time frame, he was able to complete all that within the 3 hours. In the course of the interview, detectives were also able to determine that this individual was able to obtain my address by a simple phone call to the Washington County Taxation Department. Excuse me, and just simply provided my name, asked if I did own property within that county, and that information was provided to him over the telephone. He was not required to. I later contacted the taxation department myself. This individual was not required to give any type of information whatsoever, just simply asked for my name. And that's all I have at this point.
Question?
Thank you.
I think you've done well. Thank you for your testimony. We'll have James Morales. Paul Snyder.
Yeah.
And Diane. Badrick.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, James Morales, Benton County Clerk, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I provided some written testimony on House Bill 2724, as well as the proposed amendment did come from the Oregon Association of County Clerks, so the dash ones are the result of that proposed amendment. I feel that as far as the records and liens go, that the amendment will take care of our concerns. We did also identify certain other things within the testimony, that being, for one, there are alternate routes for any records that are recorded in our offices to not contain the residence information of law enforcement officials, and that being... And it is practiced in many counties where a law enforcement official having these concerns utilizes either a P.O. box or the sheriff or city police department address for their return document to address. The importance of these records, of course, are vital to our economy in that we title companies, banks, other organizations depend on the records that we maintain for the business that they conduct in our communities. One of the portions that we identified, and Brian also spoke to, was the lack of information about how would we know when we have a public safety officer that came into our office, and this goes beyond the county clerk's offices. The public record is a very broad record, applies to many offices and agencies throughout the counties, the states, the cities. It does not include how we were going to identify these public safety officers. And maybe Paul could speak a little more to that, but that is a concern of ours as well. This amendment will take care of the recording concerns that we have. But also, being a county clerk, I also have a responsibility for elections. And currently, we will hold a voter registration record confidential, but it takes the individual's efforts to come to our office and let us know, hey, look, I'm a public safety officer or I'm a judge, whatever the case might be, I'd like you to hold my voter registration information confidential, and we gladly accommodate that. But it needs to be made clear, I think, also in this bill, that in order for any local, state, or state agencies to hold these records confidential, we need these individuals to come to our office and let us know that, hey, I'm a public safety officer. As per this ORS, I'd like you to hold my record confidential. Otherwise, it would be a nightmare of exchanging of information and having new hires, terminations, career changes, totally throwing our efforts to track these individuals into a tailspin. So that is another consideration that perhaps Paul can speak a little more about. But thank you for allowing me to come here today.
Thank you very much. Questions of the witness? All right, we'll move on. Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the Committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and we concur with the comments made by Mr. Morales, but there are a couple of issues that I think should be important to the committee. We've also heard from appraisers and assessors with respect to this legislation about how we would know who the public safety officer is. Often there are city police officers that the county wouldn't know about, police officers who work in another county but live in this county, people who become police officers right after their certification who obviously were not police officers before. It's not a self-executing kind of public records exemption as most of the others are. You can tell by the nature of the record itself with respect to other exemptions that this is a public record that shouldn't be provided for public scrutiny. That isn't the case if you don't know who the public safety officers are. And the definition in ORS 181.610, I think, is rather broad. It includes the folks you would normally think of with respect to city, county, school district, court district, mass drugs district, but it also includes Indian Reservation, Criminal Justice Division, Department of Justice, State Lottery Commission, State Police, District Attorney investigators, and investigators who have been certified as a peace officer in another state. So the definition is rather broad. Nonetheless, we recognize the need to be able to keep these records confidential for the reasons that were given by Mr. DeLashmet. So we'd like to have an opportunity to work with him to see if we can address these problems and still honor the intent of the legislation.
Chair. Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Paul, the definition I looked up, because I was looking to see how broad it was earlier, it's under 181.610.16. Were you referring to something else? Because the list you just read didn't, and what I'm looking at for public safety officer or public safety personnel is not the same as what you just gave
us. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I was looking at public safety officer, the definition in subsection 14.
Well, number 14 is police officer, and the way the bill is written.
Okay, public safety officer.
And so if you go over to the next column, number 16, it's a much more limited, more first responder types and corrections.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I think public safety, well, it doesn't really say officer in 16, it says personnel.
And then if you continue, that says public safety personnel and public safety officer include corrections officers, youth corrections officers, emergency medical dispatchers, parole and probation officers, police officers, certified reserve officers, telecommunicators, and fire service professionals.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I think that's even broader than the one I was looking at because it incorporates the definition of police officer from subsection 14. so it includes subsection 14 plus the others listed in 16. If I'm reading this right.
Well, we can work through this, but on the bill that's on page 5, line 16, which is in bold print number 33, it says home address, home telephone number, and electronic mail address of a public safety officer as defined under 181610. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page for the record, since we are making a record of this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, I think we are. Public safety personnel in subsection 16, well, I don't see public safety officer as such defined, but I assume that means public safety personnel. And if it does, then it would also include police officers defined in subsection 14 plus the others that are listed in subsection 16. Is that right?
That's not the way I see the bill. I read it as it's only the sub 16, because for peace officer or police officer, I knew pretty much who that was covered, and that's what threw me when I saw public safety officer. I wasn't sure what was being included.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, it is a broad definition in 16 anyway, and it still gives us the same problem as we described earlier, and that is, how do we know who they are if they don't tell us?
Well, and I agree with that. I mean, I've had those exemptions for my records as a prosecutor, but we had to go through the process of filing it with the clerk and such. So I think that's would be, I mean, you can't put it on the clerk. I understand. I think the committee understands that we don't know who's who. They have to actually bring this forward, and there'll be a requirement that some type of paperwork crosses his hands.
Let's go and take testimony of Diane. I think we perhaps have some work to do here before this bill comes back, but please, Diane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diana Bradrick, and I'm the manager of cartography and records in the Assessment Taxation Division of Washington County. I won't take up any more of your time. What's been said here by Mr. Snyder is exactly what I came to testify to. We just need a mechanism for identifying the individuals.
Thank you. If there's no further questions from the committee, I'm going to ask Representative.
Yes. Just curious, did you guys raise these objections in the House?
This particular bill moved quite expeditiously through the House and did not really have a chance to identify it until it was very late in the process, and did provide some information to the representatives, but it was already going to the floor and it was a bit late. So, yeah, it did move quite fast.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Yes,
if sir. I ask counsel, was this part of that Friday when they had 20-something or 30 bills, whatever it was?
No. This okay. was, let me take a look. We, Senator Przanski and members of the committee, we had a criminal subcommittee on meeting on this on March 15th. It passed out of the criminal subcommittee and then went to the full committee on March 18th. So this was before we got real busy.
Further questions, comments? Thank you. I'd like to have the representative, sponsor of the bill, come forward and Galiso. Yes, Brian, come back. We're going to take some more testimony here. This is a public hearing today. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Larry Galizio, House District 35, and I'll try to be brief. You know, expeditiously in the House or in this building is a subjective term, but from what I've seen in the time that I've been here, this bill has gone through a process that has been, if not lengthy, certainly deliberative enough so that there was ample opportunity and plenty of time for these types of concerns to come forward, and I'm actually quite surprised that we're in this position, and I wish the county had come forward with any concerns they had. Secondly, I think in the end, and I know you, this is what we do all day long, it's sort of weighing priorities. And for me, and the reason I sponsored this bill is when you have the safety of the families and the children and officers who protect the rest of us in jeopardy, and we can make a rather simple change, and you weigh that against concerns about from companies, title companies, etc., which I'm not really sure those are that significant. I think this is an easy call. I think we owe it to the men and women who protect all of us and their families. This was a very disturbing incident that I heard about, and it's one of, you know, it's not completely isolated. So I would just urge you to really weigh the questions here.
Mr. Chair. Senator Brzezinski.
Larry, I mean, one of the, I had to step outside in here. Everything was discussed, but it appears to me that the clerks do have a valid point that there's going to be some way that they're noticed as to what's who is actually wants that coverage benefit, and it seems to be, in my opinion, would be appropriate to be affirmative on the part of the individual seeking it to fill out a piece of paper so people who work at the clerk's office know who is and that they're who they say they are, and they get that protection.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I think Brian could probably speak better to that, but my understanding, or at least the intent of the way the legislation or the way the bill is written, is to not be too prescriptive. In other words, you know, sometimes we do things in this building and tell each local sort of jurisdiction to do things in a particular way. So that was the reasoning, but I think Brian could probably add to that.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Senator Brzezinski, we actually had a conscious discussion about this when this bill was being drafted and made the determination not to get so prescriptive in the statute that it required each clerk to provide a form that looked like it was on white paper and was 15 pages, you know, sentences long, and it required this information, but just put it on the record that, in fact, we're going to leave it to each jurisdiction to come up with an affirmative process in which the officer identified themselves and said, I'd like this information kept confidential. So we went through that same mental exercise as you're going through and decided, rather than being prescriptive in the statute, we would leave it to the jurisdictions to do that. I would like to make one additional comment, however, on the first point that Representative Galizio talked about as far as this bill flying very fast. I've been working on this bill for a long time. It had a very deliberative hearing in March. That's not early in the session. The bill had been printed very early in the session, so it wasn't like it was a sneak attack very quickly that went through the process. There was ample opportunity. I did have a discussion with Mr. Morales from the clerks about several weeks after the bill had passed the House, in which they raised the issue of the liens, and I said, I think that's appropriate. I just saw the dash ones today. I think that takes care of that problem. The new issue that he raises, as I had indicated, is something that we thought about and made a determination not to include in this, and I just as soon have the bill in the way it is now with that process being allowed to be jurisdiction by jurisdiction specific.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Brian, I mean, couldn't you leave it jurisdiction by jurisdiction and simply insert language something like, you know, at the end of line 17 on page 5, where you put your new language in, put some if so requested by the public safety officer. That way would make it clear that to the county clerks and to the people that if they've been requested to keep it confidential, they have to, but if they haven't been requested to, then they have no idea if this person is a public safety officer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, I have no problem with that specific of a situation. Again, what we were trying to get away from was being so prescriptive that we were even talking about forms. I have no problem with that amendment if they want to bring that specific amendment the way it is.
I'll do it. Okay. I can just get it drafted.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think we're all on the same page. It's just from an attorney perspective, the liability, if they don't do something and they say, well, I was a police officer, now my family could potentially have that issue. So I think it does need to be the affirmative, just like others have to do it for the voting records and stuff like that. Once they do that, and I think what Senator Beyer has suggested, we'll take care of all of our concerns and we'll get this through.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Beyer, Chair Starr, Council, I see you're taking notes. We are fine with that as the solution.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Anybody else want to? Yes, please.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And I'm interested in having the record reflect the fact that we support the Dash 1 amendments, which I think solve a very serious problem that would relate to deed records and property-related records, and I don't think we need to run that out right now. But, and the other thing is, obviously, the other reason I'm identifying my interest is that it looks like there's going to be ongoing work, and so we'll be interested in being a participant in any ongoing massaging that occurs relative to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments before we close the public hearing? Council will be drafting the amendment as suggested by Senator Beyer. Bills will be coming back next week. Appreciate the work and the participation of multiple council. We have gotten through our schedule for the day. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2724. We're going to adjourn Senate Judiciary. Thank you very much.